Hey there, folks. We're kicking off today's episode with a cup of tea from the Nepal Tea Collective. Nepal Tea is a social enterprise based in New York that distributes the freshest organically grown teas to different parts of the world directly from smallholder farmers in the beautiful country of, you guessed it, Nepal. You can join us for a cup of tea and be part of the global impact they're creating by visiting nepalteacollective.com. That's nepalteacollective.com. Yikes, my cup of tea is already getting cold. So why don't you join me and hop into today's episode?
Jaziel did not always know that he would find himself in the startup world. But after an early career on Wall Street, he realized the need to rethink how we support and invest in Africa's most exciting entrepreneurs. Hailing from Ghana, Jaziel is an African investment officer at Axion Venture Lab, where he leads the growth of a dynamic portfolio of finance technology startups. In this episode, we uncover Jaziel's unconventional journey into the venture capital industry and his fascinating insights as to why more investors need to focus on women-led startups in particular. With a deep belief in the transformational power of entrepreneurship in Africa, Jaziel brings a refreshing and reflective perspective into how we should go about building and investing in companies that have world-changing potential. Join us for yet another exciting episode in the boardroom this week.
Good morning, good evening, or good afternoon, whoever you are, wherever you are. Welcome to the Boardroom Banter podcast. You're joining me on today's episode. I'm your host, Sean Karanja, and today we have something special for you guys. It doesn't take a genius to know that, you know, I live and breathe startups, anything, entrepreneurship, etc. I geek out every single time with one of our guests, and today is going to be no exception. We have someone who I'd actually consider a thought leader in the space. I don't know whether he identifies as one, you know, these things are relative, but what I find is often thought leaders don't think they're thought leaders, but like us who are waiting eagerly for their tweets to drop and their newsletters, regard them as such. And today I am joined in the boardroom by none other than Jaziel Martin Odum. Jaziel is the Africa Investment Officer at Axion Venture Lab, and he's joining us all the way from the United States. But the thing about Jaziel is that he travels all the time, talking to founders, talking to some of the investors on the fund, meeting new people, learning new stuff. And Jaziel, welcome to the Boardroom Banter podcast. It's an honor to have you here.
Thanks for having me here, Sean. It is a pleasure, and thanks for your way too kind words. I wouldn't call myself a thought leader. I'm just a guy with a Twitter who talks way too much. But I do enjoy it, and it's always helpful to hear that other people find it valuable as well. So thank you for giving me an hour of your time to be a part of what is a really interesting and engaging podcast.
Yeah, no, Jaziel, I think the honor is mine, because for a while I've been following you on Twitter, and you know, when I think of myself as an entrepreneur and the journey that it's taken to get to where I am, wherever that is, oftentimes we look for individuals like yourself who have sat down with founders, solving all sorts of problems, helped them brainstorm through stuff, invested in them. So I know you're also an angel investor as well.
Yes.
So you do put your money where your mouth is in many ways. And I'm really, really excited to just dig into, you know, like who you are, how did you get here, etc. So, you know, before we geek out about all the VC stuff, tell us, you know, who's Jaziel today, and, you know, maybe how would you describe your life's work to like a 10-year-old?
That's great. Who is Jaziel today is a very big question that me and my therapist spent a lot of time thinking about. I think the short answer to who Jaziel is, like, you mentioned I'm in the United States today, but I normally live in Kenya, but I'm Ghanaian by origin. So I think Jaziel is a guy that was born in Africa, lived around the world, come back home, and really obsessed with this idea of how do we leverage capital as a tool to actually bring forth the potential of Africa that we keep claiming. And to you alluded earlier that angel invest, one of the pieces for me that is really important is backing women-led founders and expanding how many more women are raising innovative capital to be able to build interesting businesses. And so who just here today is just a guy from Ghana whose day job is hanging out and talking to people and investing in their companies. But how would I describe all of that to a 10-year-old? I often tell people that what I do is I tell people who have ideas that I'll give them money for them to test their idea out. And if it goes very well, all of us will make money together. And most importantly, all of us will have an impact on more people that look like us, more 10-year-olds, more 20-year-olds, more 50-year-olds, more 100-year-olds, whoever is part of this African ecosystem that we love to talk about. My day job is being a part of making that reality possible. So I don't know how many 10-year-olds know the word reality, but here we are.
Yeah, nowadays 10-year-olds have the full might of the internet on their fingertips. So, these kids nowadays surprise me.
Absolutely. And it's a good thing. It's a good thing.
I'm assuming back when you were a 10-year-old, you didn't really have the internet. Sorry to date you like that,
Yeah, I was like, "Ooh, you're dating me." Don't let it, I passed. Like the other day, I got like someone told me I looked 23. I was like, "That's amazing. I love the fact that you're
Yeah, you
calling
do.
me 23."
You do.
That's amazing. Thank you also.
Yeah.
But I'd say, yes, definitely very different from when I grew up. Like I was born and raised in Ghana, right? And
Yeah.
the internet may have been like was still starting when I was 10 years old, but was definitely more advanced in more developed countries than it was in Ghana. Like I remember, internet cafes and going to sit there trying to figure out how to make my first like Yahoo email. My dad trying to figure out what Yahoo actually meant. So yeah,
Right.
it's very, very different. But I'd say my early year schooling, I was again brought up in Ghana. So very good nearby culture. My parents and my younger brother still live back home. I went to mostly private elementary schools in Ghana, and then followed it up by going to high school at a school called Akosombo International School, also in Ghana. And so I've always been, because I was born and raised, kind of did my first call 18 years in Ghana, I've always had this immense sense of home that's always been a part of like who I am and the way I think about things. And you see that even in how I think about investing and how my career has evolved over time. But I'd say one of the biggest parts of my culture that has shaped who I am today, and what I think to help me and has helped me understand the work I do is that most Ghanaians are known to be quote unquote hospitable. All that means the Ghanaians talk way too much. And I'm
And say
Ghanaian and I
please a
talk way
lot.
too much. Oh yes, which listen, the right please can get you some really interesting results. But yeah, so Ghanaians, we talk too much and we say please a lot, which on their own feel like two separate things. But when you become someone whose job is talking to people who are building the future of a world that we can't yet imagine, the ability to talk to people is a big part. And also his ability to give people space to imagine and to think and to dream. I think that's what my day job is. And that's something that I would say my parents allowed me to do. Not
Right.
many African parents, especially back then, would allow the 18-year-old to decide that, hey, listen, I think there's a school in America that I want to do, so I'm going to go do it. My dad was like, I've never been to America before. I
Yeah.
don't know what even people do to get to America, but if you can figure it out, we'll let you go. And I think that freedom to, if you can figure it out, we'll let you go, has been a part of how I end up even doing this work. I figure if I figure it out, I can keep going. And that's what I keep doing 20, well, I shouldn't say how many years ago now, because that would date me.
That's interesting. I do see that, you had some time studying and working out in the US. So, I'm assuming that would be like, early 20s when, you're
Yes, for
out
sure.
there. I know you did a stint in investment banking as well. So,
Absolutely.
you've had a pretty interesting trajectory. Let's talk
Yes.
about that just a bit.
For sure. Let's talk about it just a bit. So yeah, I think again, can't continue the timeline. So around 18 years or so, I decided that I wanted to go to the States for college, so I moved to New York for college. I went to a private Catholic university called St. John's University in Queens. And there, a long time ago, I used to think I wanted to study forensic psychology. And so I went to St. John's and got a degree in forensic psychology. So a lot of people don't know this about me, but my undergraduate degree is in forensic psychology. But I also,
And
because
what's that?
again,
What's
exact
forensic
great question.
psychology?
I was gonna, that's not an amazing question. What is forensic psychology? I had to explain that to my parents when I said I was going to go to school. So happy to explain
Imagine.
it on the podcast. Yeah, for sure. Because listen, if it's not a doctor, it's not a lawyer, it's not an engineer, really, who,
Exactly.
what is this job? So essentially, I grew up reading a lot. And I was at the time, and still am actually, really fascinated by how why people do what they do. And so forensic psychology, in its essence, is a study of criminals and their motivations, why they do what they do, and how do you determine like how to rehabilitate criminals, how to support people build better justice systems that aren't just punitive and making people, go back to jail every time. And so that was like, again, back to this culture of like really want to figure out how do we support people. I really came to the US thinking, I want to work, I want to understand how people think about crimes and why they commit crimes, which led me in my early 20s, before I found finance, I did a lot of work in rehabilitation of juvenile delinquents. That's people who are young that have offended, that have offended or made any mistake that potentially could land them in jail. And again, keeping in with this theme of like my focus on women-led companies now, my research, this was again years ago, now over a decade ago now, but my research was specifically around the fact that there wasn't a lot of research done around how women in prison systems behave or react, or and does it actually help them? What kind of programs are designed for specifically women and the reasons why they commit crimes? And so my research was building, was thinking through how do we build out a specific program focused on young women who may have done misdemeanors or small-time crimes and put them in a program that is not jail, that can put them on the trajectory to be better. So for a while, that was like a big focus of mine until, as it happens, I came across a book. And this book was called How to Change the World by David Bornstein. And that book, at the time, I was my minor, my degree is social justice and international business. And so this book was really a reading I had to do for my class. But in reading this book, I realized that this guy was talking about all these people in Africa and India who were getting money and then using it to build companies that were impactful to people. So he had mentioned people like an Acumen program. He had mentioned people that were building ag tech companies in Africa. And for me, that was a light bulb moment, right? Because I grew up in Ghana, and my perspective had always been that if you needed money, you went to a nonprofit to get money. And that book made me see that there was ways to hit impact without having to do, we have to go get nonprofit money, because, and we can talk about that in another podcast. But that is what led me down the path of, well, who are the people that are financing these guys, and what does that look like? And so in my early 20s, I went from being very focused on criminal justice to getting very excited about innovation and how do we support and back companies. And that led me to NYU, where I got a master's specifically in impact investments and innovation. And what that allowed me to do is allow me to be the first one, the first group of student managers for NYU's Impact Investment Fund. For those that don't know, NYU runs a student-led VC fund that is essentially designed for graduate students who want to improve their skill sets around finding and investing in startups. And that was really my first foray at 20 years old. Like, oh, this is a really interesting concept. It's a really interesting idea. I can do it. But post-graduation, like most people, I went to find a job and I need a job that will pay me. And so I thought to myself, well, I want to invest in startups, but I don't know what the end state of startups look like. After you go to the seed round, after you go to the Series A and get on TechCrunch, what happens after that, right? And no one really seemed to know. It was, yeah, you keep raising, eventually you IPO. I was like, well, what does it mean to IPO? That's what led me to be an investment banker, really to learn those hard skills of finance. So like, what does it mean to value a company? What does it mean to exit a company? How do we think about merging companies? So at Goldman Sachs, I specifically covered industrials M&A, which is mergers and acquisitions. And broadly what that meant was I was helping aerospace and defense companies, global business services companies, European building and construction businesses to buy and sell each other or to raise capital. And that was really, so when I was 20 years old, that's really what I was doing. But around the time I had moved to London, we had just entered the pandemic. And so I looked up and I was just like, I don't want to keep working in London and I don't want to keep being an investment banker, because I came to Goldman Sachs ostensibly because I wanted to understand how to back founders. So I thought it made sense to go back. And so, unlike most 20-year-olds in London, I made the decision to say goodbye to my job, goodbye to my work visa, and move back home to Ghana. And that is what led me on this journey. But we can talk about that, I'm sure, in your next question.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that just sounds like, first of all, a major pivot. I think a lot of us who take non-obvious or, the less beaten path, we oftentimes have those situations where, you're sitting down and you have to explain, okay, why this degree to, a parent, or, why this venture to, friends, family. Major pivots are fundamentally uncomfortable. But I think, if I'm to reflect on that a bit, with the different things that you are learning from a psychology standpoint, why do people do what they do? Moving into finance, where, from my own experience in this space, there's a lot of, yes, why do people do what they do, but also why do people buy what they buy, or why do people, build what they build, or why do
Yeah,
consumers prefer
absolutely.
this versus that? I can definitely see how that background, translated into your work on Wall Street, etc. But you then moved into, you came back to the motherland. Kudos to you. You didn't contribute entirely to brain drain, but
Well, let's not knock brain drain till you try it. I'm just saying. But yes.
the grass sometimes can be greener.
Listen, especially when the grass that we have hasn't gone water in so long, you can't blame people for making the move.
For sure, for sure. When you think of your work in VC, so you came back and now you are sitting down. You came from, I guess, this like bird's nest view where you're working with these like global conglomerates, etc., at Goldman. And now you're coming into a VC space where it's a lot smaller, a bit more niche, smaller transaction sizes, and people who are working with real problems. Could you talk to us a bit about some of what you saw people solving, and the entrepreneurship landscape that you've observed in Africa? And maybe we can now shift the conversation into, okay, how have you observed successful entrepreneurs build, and maybe those who weren't so successful? Are there certain blind spots or things that they overestimate or underestimate about building in Africa, specifically?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think to answer the question, I'll take one step back and fill the gap between. So me for left Goldman Sachs, came back to Ghana. I came back to Ghana, actually, I was working remotely, but I was working for a US-based accelerator. And the accelerator, my job was being the portfolio manager for their startups in UK, Europe, Middle East, and Africa, about 100 of those startups. And my job was helping them raise funding and helping them build out strategic capabilities to hit their goals. And I did that for a bit. And then eventually that's I started to launch a fund, and I was investing Series A broadly in US, UK, and Asia. And so kind of like doing this in my day job, but also sitting in Ghana day to day and working with founders pro bono with my friend and business partner every once in a while, William, who runs a company called Spear Capital Advisory in Ghana. We did a lot of work, like just doing pro bono work with founders. My colleague William, actually, together with that guy Desmond, launched this grant making program last year. We gave out quite a bit of money to about 12 founders in Ghana on a non-dilutive basis. So I was doing all this like day-to-day job in APAC and at night talking with my friends who are supporting entrepreneurs back in Ghana. And so to your initial question, what I talk about entrepreneurship and VC and thinking about what goes into that, into the successes and failures. I think the very first piece that I think we should be honest to founders about is that most the 99% of the reasons why things succeed are out of, well, maybe not anything, but half of the things that you succeed, why a company will succeed, are really no one can guess what those things are. A lot of times what you're looking to do is figure out how does a company build success? And sometimes you can test some things and you can estimate some things, but the real truth, I think, what makes a successful business is two main things, right? One, are you targeting a problem that's big enough? And two, is the problem painful enough to people who are willing to pay for it? I think so many times, one thing that I've learned, especially in Africa, is that, especially because I invested in the US, but I can invest in Africa, is the fact that US has probably the highest middle class, or high GDP per capita compared to any African country. It's like upwards of 100x, like more than Africa, right? So the capacity of people to buy more stuff, even if it's not a critical need for them, is a lot higher. Whereas if you're building in Africa, a lot of times people, I think eventually we might get there, right? Where people have enough money that they want you to give them, I don't know, vegan dog food, for example, and you could build a business around in Africa. But I think today, a lot of people, you look at stats, right? A lot of people spend 67% of their income on food, right? So your startup is going to be fighting with how much they buy, how much they get for food, how much they pay for electricity, et cetera. And so really, like, so many founders, I think the best founders understand that even if the problem is large and it's painful, you have to find the person who is willing and able to pay for this. So a lot of startups like myself, I want to solve, I don't know, let's say something for smallholder farmers. One of my portfolio companies in AVL is a good example, Pula. Pula is looking to sell insurance to smallholder farmers, but they don't make the smallholder farmers pay for the insurance. They have a more B2G to C approach where they are selling insurance to organizations or governments that are looking to insure these farmers. And so they're saying, hey, listen, if you can cover these farmers, make sure that when something happens, they will get their money back, then we will pay you those premiums directly. So you go from, like, most farmers are not thinking about paying for insurance premiums because, again, they get paid on a harvest by harvest basis. So you go to them saying, hey, I'm going to sell you insurance directly. You're like, that business today may not be a big business. If you say, I'm going to get insurance, but the person who's going to be paying is the person who is willing and able to pay because the government wants more farmers to be covered in case of farm accidents, or NGOs that are focused on agriculture are really excited about really backing, like, women farmers in Zambia, whatever those needs are, those are people that are willing to pay. And so because they're willing to pay, you can build a business model around them. So I think we could get into, like, more deep, complex thought processes. But a lot of times, like, having been an investment banker and having seen the end state of what a company can be, all companies, regardless of what they serve, are often selling to someone who is capable and willing to pay. So in Africa, the assumption of willing to pay is not there. You can't assume people are willing to pay because most people aren't, just because, like, the GDP per capita is so low. So what that then means is that if you're going to build the companies that are really successful are the companies that figure out, okay, this problem is a painful problem, but now let me go through all the stakeholders and figure out which of these people here, not only does this problem affect them, but they have capacity to pay. Now, if you can combine a big problem where people are willing to pay, and you can acquire those people who are willing to pay at a progressively lower cost, you have a VC business. Now, the journey to do what I just said is a lot more harder than than the 5 2 minutes I just kind of, like, walked through that. And I think a lot of times as investors, we talk about, like, the academic part of building a company without necessarily speaking about the actual struggles of building said company. Like, the journey to go from finding a big problem to finding customers that are willing to pay, to making those customers, to structuring an offering that makes them want to pay, to be able to collect that money and acquire more of those customers at a lower cost, that process is a very difficult process. And I think anyone that, like, takes up the mantle of innovation always has my respect, because as an investor, I see day to day how hard that journey is. And so it's an easy thing to say that if you're going to be successful, you do these things. But the journey to do that is the difference between being a unicorn and kind of, like, your startup kind of failing. I'll pause there. I don't know if that answered your question fully.
Yeah, no, for sure. just going back to what you said, you know, that incredible combination of someone is genuinely in pain or needs a better solution, or is being underserved, plus, okay, does this stakeholder in the conversation actually have the capacity to pay for this thing? An interesting dilemma that I had encountered when I started my first startup was that, you know, the approach that we took was more B2C. So, you know, I was running a skills training startup and basically creating co-curricular programs that, you know, were implementing in high school. So, you know, a lot of the stuff that we say, oh, I wish I knew in high school or this. So, we're doing that. And so the first lesson I learned was, you have to replace yourself. If the entire workflow of the business, first of all, relies on you or you being physically there or you running some sort of like in-person thing, I quickly learned that tech is a huge way to leapfrog a lot of that iterative and slow process, and also address a bigger pool of your audience. But where I think, and now of course in hindsight, now you figure out down the line. Again, just like you said, it wasn't as quick as those 5 minutes you just gave to like explain this thing. You know, it takes a long time, and it was probably like year two when I realized that first of all, students are never gonna pay for this thing, right? So, you know, I had to look up that stakeholder chain and be like, okay, will the school pay? Would you know, NGOs pay? Would such and such pay? And do you think that, you know, if let's say entrepreneurship and some of these ideas were taught like in elementary high school as standard, do you think that would change the outlook of the quality of businesses that would come out of, you know, our young innovators down the line? Like if we really think, okay, you as Jaziel, you sit here and you go through all these pitch decks, do you think that the quality of our startup ecosystem would be a lot better if we had some sort of like entrepreneurship training going on or like design thinking? Because the reason I ask is the answer you gave to the previous question is evidence of a design thinking process. So someone has to have had this, you know, type of iterative thought process ingrained to figure that out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think this is a great question. Should entrepreneurship be taught in schools? So is the question broadly, or should we be teaching entrepreneurship to help people not fall into the same like gaps that most people are falling into? It's a tricky one. I'm gonna say I don't know the answers. I don't know the answer to it, but I will share my opinion. I think my opinion is that there are certain things that are constant, right? There are certain challenges that are constant. For example, your challenge you just mentioned about the fact that students will not pay. Any edtech company should know that students won't pay. No matter how well your offering is, students are not going to pay. They don't have independent money. So I think there is a conversation to be had around more entrepreneurs, both successes and failures, and even investors who have seen successes and failures, being more open to sharing what they've learned in that pace, in that space. Now, whether or not there is like an entrepreneurship university for young people to build something, I think that's a thesis. They have an idea to want to build a scalable business, right? Something I thought was interesting you said was that you realize that if you're doing everything, it cannot work. And that's the very first like VC like barrier is this a scalable model? Because I need you to go from 10 people to 1 million people. How does that happen? And then a lot of startups, a lot of accelerators out there that are doing this work of like helping founders think about some of these pieces early. I do think, however, that we need more. I think there's so much of it is academic, right? People say, like, and I'm part of the problem, right? I tweet about like customer segmentation, or I tweet about get your pitch deck in 14 slides. Anyways, okay, cool. I have my pitch deck in 14 slides. I'm gonna segment my customers. I'll do some investment updates, and boom, I've built a business, right? Whereas, like, if you are building a neobank versus if you are building a B2B marketplace, the things you need to know are two very different things. Or if you build an e-commerce company and Jumia, Conga, all these guys have failed. but you don't really know why they have failed, then you have like a bit of an issue. I'll give you a really good example. There's a found the founder of this South African company called Lynx. They were really early into this idea of like service-based marketplaces. And Charles, one of the co-founders, he wrote a really good article about why they failed, right? And I've read the article multiple times, but and that article is now maybe 3, 4 years old. Till today, I still get companies that have pitched me they want to build a services marketplace, and 99% of them are all repeating the same mistake that Lynx already did that helped them fail. And the founder put out like, "Hey, this is why we failed. We're going to build this model. It's really hard to do it for these three reasons. So if you're going to build this, you need to find a way to solve these three things before you get to it." Most people don't know that exists, and so a lot of people still pitch you the same company, and you're like, "Well, I've seen this before. It's going to fail." So the more, so I don't know if it's school, like making intervention in school, I think it's more around thought leadership, right? And it's why I like a few different people who think through some of these things. I think Emeka from AfriDigest and his team out there, they're really focused on expanding.
Fantastic, fantastic newsletter.
Exactly. AfriDigest is amazing, right? And I think they're very focused on this idea of adding to thought leadership in this space. The Flip with Justin Norman is another one that's very focused on adding thought leadership in this space. Marge and Tandy, right, sourcing Africa to invest, also very focused on like adding lessons to this space. So I do think that like we need more people to share the lessons because some of these failures are unforced errors. And more the more we share to people what has happened, what they can learn, what learnings are there, the more people can potentially avoid some of these pain points and maybe build a big business, you know?
I definitely hear you on that, especially in light of, when we had the COVID downturn and, when we look at the macro environment for VC in general, there has been a bit of a dry up in terms of, VCs and how much they can actually put into businesses. Interest rates went up, so the cost of finance now is much more expensive. So, they're taking their time and having to make smarter decisions about who to invest in. And a lot of times that outlook is misinterpreted for okay, maybe African startups are just terrible and like that's why we are seeing so many failures popping up, or these founders, are terrible people and this that. And as people who are Twitter or rather X, daily users almost, we see this banter going around and fingers being pointed. I do like to see when a founder has failed and they sum up why it happened. They give a breakdown, they and basically say, hey, look, we basically tossed our hat into this thing. We cast our lot, we shot our shot, we did what we could, and it just didn't work out for XYZ reason. I think, if we romanticize startups a bit less, we'll come to terms with these things a lot easier, because the truth of entrepreneurship is that, when you see the
It's
stats
hard
of
work.
like 90% fail, out the gate, and even your business model as a VC, Jaziel, is one that's based on, the power law, which is, most of your investments will either lose you money or just break even, and maybe like one, two will return the whole fund back plus more or 10x, 100x, right?
That's the
So
goal.
that is the goal, and we wish you all the best with that. But I'm interested, right? So there's two things that pop up when I go through your content and during your office hours, listen to what you put out in the world. Two things that strike me as important to you, right? So number one is gender lens investing, right? So you have this big determination to even out the playing field, make sure that there are more women-led startups getting funding and winning, right? That's number one. Number two, also, I guess by virtue of Axion Ventures, you guys have a focus on fintech as well, right? So, finance and technology-backed, or rather powered companies. I'm curious just to know, you as a VC, as a person, as an angel investor, beyond these two? You know, are there any other, you know, emerging trends? You could also speak about those two, but you know, when you look at trends and solutions or ideas that you're really excited about, what does that look like for you?
It's a great question. I might answer a bit more far-ranging than you expected, but I'll pick out a couple of pieces. The very first piece I'll pick out is the gender lens investing piece. And to your audience, hear me when I say this. It sounds nice that I invest in women-led companies, but I don't do it because it's charity. I actually don't really optimize for charity. The reason I invest in women-led companies is because it's a better business approach. Why am I saying that? Because there's tons of data out there that proves that teams that have gender diverse members and or are led by women in their companies, one, and this is the part I care about the most, they return 78%, 78 cents to the dollar compared to all male teams returning 31 cents to the dollar.
Oh
Now,
man.
this is data that has been proven and tested across different geographies and different markets. So it's not a one market blip. So I think for me, the very first thing, like, to your point, like, if we're gonna assume that power law means that 90% of my investments are gonna fail, I need to give myself, as an especially an angel investor who's investing my own money, right? I'm not an exit founder, I don't have $1 million. I'm literally just like my monthly salary, a portion of it goes into a savings, and every 4 months I'll have enough money. Let me I'll do one small check. And so for me, I'm optimizing for making money, right? I'm not optimizing for like feeling good about myself. And if I'm optimizing for making money and I look at the data, I think a lot of investors are predisposed to assume because of like Elon Musk, because of Mark Zuckerberg, because of Evan from Snapchat, people are almost like hardwired to assume that the best businesses have single male or all male founder teams. But that's actually not true. No, most of the companies that lose money are single male or all male founder teams. But
Oh man.
most VCs don't talk about that, right? Because no one wants to say the fact that Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Evan, all those guys. For every one of those guys, there's the founder of Ginkgo, there's the founders of Andela, there's founders of Grow Intelligence, there's founders of Pula, who have built huge businesses that are women-led companies. But because in mainstream media, et cetera, we talk about, Facebook and Twitter, and we're always going back and forth between Elon and Zuckerberg. So a lot of investors, unfortunately, have this presumption, a lot of founders as well, that if you want to build the best team, you get you and your boy, two guys together, we can't be sleeping in our rooms, we build Twitter. Like, that's not how it works. I think data shows. And so for me, I'm as an investor who is looking at multiple opportunities, I want to make money. So for me, gender lens investing, yeah. So we can talk about the impact piece. And the impact piece is clear. Like, I can tell you right now, the women-led teams or gender diverse teams produce more impactful solutions. They are more innovative, even in outside of even beyond just entrepreneurial innovation. Even women in surgery teams are more innovative in the solution they come up in surgery than if it was all male in surgeries, right? Like, the concept of diversity isn't a check mark. It's about how do we make these businesses better. And so for me, I think a lot of people look at gender investing and they think, oh, you're investing in substandard companies because they have women. And I'm actually talking to I invest in really above standard companies because I know that it's so much harder for women to get capital. But my thesis is that if as I invest in more women founders, I'm actually locking in better returns. Again, who knows if I'm right? I might be wrong. All I just said to you right now is academic data, and a lot of people are smarter than me have proven it out with their research. But to me, I think that too many people say stuff like this and have read articles and have opinions, and I won't be able to prove that myself. And that's why I use my own money to invest in. I have now done seven investments in women-led companies across Africa, UK, and the US, because I want to be able to prove out this thesis that if you invest in women-led companies, in 10 years, my goal is to prove that you can make more money. Anecdotally, this Shark Tank guy, Kevin O'Leary, he announced that like for his Shark Tank deals, women, the ones come that have done 75% of his returns have come from women-led companies.
Yeah, I saw that.
Most of the male companies he invested in failed,
They
right?
flopped.
And these are all anecdotal information that exists, right? So I think that's the number one on generalist investing. But kind of staying with this theme, another trend that I'm excited about in Africa specifically is this idea of democratizing early stage investing. As an angel investor, I invest via a bunch of syndicates. And syndicates, for those who don't know, are groups of people who come together to decide to invest in companies that one person, usually the administrator of the syndicate, has gone to do a DD for, et cetera. And I'm a part of a few different syndicates. I'm a part of Coke Club, Nairobi Business Angel Association, Afropreneur, Hustle Fund, Alumni Angel with Maria Rutilu. And for me, one of the things I'm really excited about is how do we leverage the idea of syndicates to get more and more people who are young, who are founders, who may want to get into innovation but don't want to build companies, and to be able to be a part of diversifying the pool of people that are investing early stage funding. Because what you find in Africa is a lot of people want to invest in like a seed round, a Series A, Series B, but that like pre-seed angel round space. There's a
Yes.
very concentrated group of people who do angel investing. So a trend that I'm excited about is the growth of more syndicates in Africa specifically. And there's some really interesting companies that are coming up now that are doing that. I know Joe and Yao are building this company called Platform, which is going to help power syndicates in Africa. They're trying to trialing it with the Hulk Club, which Joe and a few other people led. So I think there's some really interesting trends in syndicates and democratizing angel investing that I'm quite excited about on the personal side. And I think the final thing you mentioned on the fintech side. So on the fintech side, again, as a reminder to folks, I work for Axiom Venture Lab. We're pre-seed to pre-A fintech investor. I say our sweet spot is really in that C stage. We're writing checks anywhere from about 500K to about 1 million. And then we can follow on in subsequent rounds up to an extra million. So all in, we can do about 2 million in the company. And for my job at Axiom Venture Lab, a few things I'm quite excited about. Say, I call it like three things. I began the year with a bunch of things, but I think I've kind of narrowed my focus down to three things mainly. The very first one is verticalized SaaS software
Nice.
in specific niches. So I think that like a lot of companies have come out that wanted to like digitize SMEs broadly. And I think that while that's a noble goal, I think every SME group is very different and they have very different needs, very different acquisition strategies. And so I think that people who can build in specific niches, whether let's say travel or Order, for example, in Nigeria, they do that for small, medium-scale restaurants, and they have a verified SaaS software company. Duplo in Nigeria does that for B2B payments. And there's a bunch of companies that are, I think you can build some really interesting verticalized SaaS software companies in Africa if you find specific niches of SMEs that are large enough and the problem and have a painful enough problem that they are willing to pay for it. I think that's one. So vertical SaaS, I'm quite excited about. And kind of like tangential to that, I think I'm really excited about payments. I think everybody knows Flutterwave, knows Paystack, knows Revio, who just raised recently, but I'm really excited by specific payment solutions. So I'll say three things in payments I'm excited about. One is B2B payments. So companies that are building up payment for specific niches, say construction, say industrials, materials, say
Yes.
beauty. Those are things I'm quite excited about in B2B payments. Also, cross-border payments infrastructure. So people that are making it easier to send money across different borders, especially if you're targeting specific corridors, maybe you're targeting East to West Africa, or you're targeting China to West Africa, or China to Africa, or China to East
Right.
Africa. I think those areas are really interesting broadly. And finally, like this idea of like digital financial infrastructure. So my thesis around that is that, listen, most startups are going to come up, are eventually going to need to collect money from their customers or in some way, shape, or form. And a lot of people do that by kind of spinning up a wallet. And instead of having to deal with building out your own infrastructure, people that can build the level zero almost of infrastructure that allows people who are saying, I want to build, let's say, a pharmacy tech company, but I need a wallet and I need to be able to do lending. I can
Yeah.
get into this partner and be like, hey, I'm going to be a pharmacy guy, but you give me a wallet infrastructure, you give me a payment method infrastructure. And I think if you do that, we can start to solve some of the more fragmentation-led problems in the market. Of course, some of these models may be a bit early for the ecosystem we're in today, and we'll have to see how that plays out. And then finally, another area that I'm actually very much excited about. I haven't done any deals as yet in there, but I think it's really interesting. It is this idea of future of work. And when I think about future of work, what I'm really thinking about is like, what is one? How are we financing and supporting this changing phase of employment in Africa? So a lot of people
Right.
automatically will think like gig workers, for example, but I think
Yeah.
it's a very useful area, but it's also other players in the space. Like think about people who, for example, work in oil and gas. and do a lot of project-based work. So there's a company in Nigeria called LaborHack that is doing something really interesting in the construction industry. There's a
Yeah,
company in
I've seen
Nigeria called
that.
Molecular Pro that is also doing something very interesting in oil and gas. I think this idea of like, how do we support blue-collar workers and really build like infrastructure around them is really interesting. As a fund, Ashraf flagged, beyond Africa, we also invest in other global emerging markets. So parts of the US,
Nice.
Middle East, Pakistan, Southeast Asia, South Asia, Latin America. And one of our investments in South Asia is a company called Advance, which does this specifically for blue-collar workers. And I think there's something really interesting there. But it's also something really interesting on the other side of the world, this like digital-led creative economy, freelancers, remote
Yeah.
workers, and that's a whole other sector of customers that could potentially also that are one underserved too, but potentially may have painful enough problems that if you can solve, you can really ideally step into the flow and be that operating system for remote workers or for creatives in Africa. So those are the broad areas that I'm excited about. But as an investor, like I think the best investors continue to be one to be nerds and two to continue to be really interested in different and emerging themes. So beyond those areas, I'm always looking to see what else is coming up and what is exciting and how I can build a VC scalable business around the same.
Yeah, I have a very niche question to ask.
Sure.
You brought up SaaS. There's something that I'm building with a couple of friends of mine. Similar, vertical SaaS, picked a niche. Very interesting stuff. I'll side chat you. You might write me my first angel check.
Yeah. Try to me. Always, there's something that I think that I'm currently working on. I'm gonna be next year or so. I'm gonna try and focus on doing a few more, like one or two more verticalized SaaS deals. So
Nice.
yeah, and as a fund, we continue to expand our thinking around verticalized SaaS. Yeah, happy to kind of hear a bit about it,
Yeah,
offline for sure.
the question I've got about that, a debate I was having with our CTO actually, and it was just figuring out how do we not get competed. Sometimes, the argument around SaaS is often that when you look at the competitive landscape of software, a lot of times it's a race to zero in the sense of, you're trying to offer it as cheap as possible. It becomes a price battle between you and competitors. And probably even sometimes, if it's an important enough element of a business that you're solving for, putting on my hat, my business hat, advice to a business would be, how about you build that yourself internally, and you don't have to outsource this thing to particularly like an external software company. When you think of making a valuable vertical SaaS business, SaaS being software as a service, for anyone who was floating around that term, what are some of the things that you see in terms of getting a product into companies, because these things are often B2B, right? Business to business, like you're selling to a corporate. Oftentimes, those are the guys who have the money, right? What sticks off the top of your head again? Like what tends to stick in terms of the approach to, back to what we were talking about earlier, how you go about solving that pain point? What do you see sticks?
Yeah, I think it's a conversation around what the most painful pain point is and how do you step in there. But before I step
Yeah.
in, I'll make one caveat. I think that when money was free, a lot of people thought that that there should be a race to the bottom. We've actually
Yeah.
always thought the opposite. I think that I think too many not enough founders think about this early enough, but unit economics is really critical. I think if you're gonna loop in a SaaS business, you have to make sure you cannot be selling $1.90 because at that point you're losing money, right? You need to be able to think through. So if your SaaS offering isn't solving a painful enough problem
Yeah.
for people who are willing to pay either like a nominal fee, then you're kind of like it's gonna one is gonna be it's gonna be really tough to scale. The second thing there though is that if you're gonna be selling to big corporates, then you really have to refine that value proposition of what that initial entry point is. But again, because you want to think through how do we continue to be sticky as a very good SaaS company, one thing I think, and again, this is my thesis and happy to be proven wrong, but I think one thing that you need to do as a very good SaaS company is once you enter into a company, be thinking about what other ways can I enter into the flows. If I came in, let's say I'm
Right.
doing a B2B SaaS business that's specifically solving, I don't know, I'm saying stuff in my head now, let's say a reconciliation, for example, right? So I'm entering through reconciliation. How do I go from reconciliation to being a part of the payment flows, to being the person that
Yes.
manages their payment, maybe be managing lending? Like, I said, I think if you want to build a SaaS business, one, you have to, from the day one, be thinking about a scalable business, because SaaS is a scalable model by itself. Two, you
Yes.
have to be thinking about the pain point that you're solving. Like, and one of the best ways to test that is like stickiness and retention. I think as you are even speaking to some of these businesses and you're like, hey, I have an idea. I think it's going to be a SaaS model. I think a lot of people assume SaaS is easy. And again, back to our earlier conversation about GDP per capita, the reason SaaS has struggled is because people, if someone has to pay every month for something, it has to be worth them paying every month for it. Otherwise, they have other things they need to use their money for, right? So your entry point and your value proposition needs to be a painful problem that they can quantify. So are you saving them X amount of revenue, or are you
Or
making them
making
X
them.
amount of revenue? And if you're making them, and that's honestly, I think making is often a better sell than
For sure.
saving. If you're doing both, that's the holy grail, right? You're saving them, but you're also bringing in revenue for them. And I think if you can do so, if you can find a niche that is big enough, that has a large enough problem and a willingness to pay for a SaaS model, then yes, you can step in the flow and want to take more ownership. But I will say though that in as much as I am excited about verticalized SaaS thesis, I will say that it's definitely not an easy journey because you have revenues that need to continue to come in on a regularized basis. So here, some people test things like contract-based revenue. So maybe you lock them in for 3 months, you get a discount. Or critically, and this is a part, I think one thing I'm learning looking at a vertical SaaS software company now, your solution has to be so perfect for their problem that they don't feel like going anywhere else. That's what you can see. This company I'm looking at has like 90% retention rate year to date, right? Like that's nuts. Like for over 3 years, it's about 90%. So which means that like
Crazy.
their customers were 3 years ago, 90% of them are still with them today. That's crazy, right? But that's because the problem that you're solving is very specific initially, but within that entry point, they can now step into like business management tools, payment tools, potentially even lending, maybe even getting on the other side and helping the consumer. And that's really, I think, how you build some of these pieces out. I think Order is a good example of that in Nigeria that has really, they've really thought through how to step into the payment flow. Duplo is the same, is a really good example as well of people who can step into who have stepped into a payment flow in very interesting ways for a SaaS model. But yeah, so overall, it's an interesting model. Whether or not it takes off in Africa, I think, is a conversation around how painful the problem is and how willing your customer is to pay.
No, ab absolutely. I think fundamentally, what a business does is you solve a problem, you either add or reduce the cost somewhere there in the mix, and ideally you want to have your customers coming back to you again and again and again.
Absolutely.
It does raise like the philosophical and ethical question of, if you're really solving a problem, why, what, I was being asked this the other day, like, okay, so you and this whole business thing, but like, most businesses are in it to keep you as a customer, not really to like solve your problem once and for all. What do you think about that one? I think it took a while to give an answer. I'd like to hear yours, right? When you look at businesses, I mean,
Just make
sometimes,
sure I understand the question. You mean businesses like your customers or business like business in general?
yeah, no, like businesses in general, so a friend of mine was asking me, right, shouldn't it be like unethical, or I don't know, like shouldn't the aim of business be that you solve a problem so well that like your customer doesn't have to come back to you again like for the same thing? Ideally,
And
I know there are some.
I would argue that it is. No, sorry, continue, continue. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I was just saying that, like, maybe from an NGO standpoint, there are some that, have seen some that have the mission to like put themselves out of business because like they want to solve and eradicate the issue. I'm not sure if you've seen this. Have you ever seen, maybe I'll ask the question in a different way, right? I didn't like how that one was phrased. I found it ambiguous, and we ended up arguing a bit, but we got nowhere. We agreed to disagree. But have you ever seen a business that did so well that it just had to move out of that, like do something
It's
else?
interesting that you say that, 'cause I think that like these questions always almost always come up only when you're talking about emerging market companies, right? No one is asking Twitter why Twitter isn't solving their problems so much that we're all tweeting without a company, right? It's like, so as an investor, I think a lot of times these questions I often get from people who already have a view that African businesses are not business grade. And so you should want to step in there and then make a business and then step out. I think the different model, I think you could be a nonprofit and evergreen fund to do that. Critically speaking, VC is not the route for probably 90% of companies. So yeah, I'm sure there's
For
companies
sure.
that like people should step into and then you solve the problem and then they'll never have the problem again. And then you move on, maybe. But that's not the business model I'm running. The business model I'm running is trying to find the best company that can raise, not only raise money, but change, get to 100 million plus in revenue. That threshold of 100 million plus revenue in 10 years, 15 years, if you will, is a very high bar, right? Like it's a very, very high bar. And so to do that, I think is a you unless you want to, unless we can have a conversation about like capitalism as a whole, and that's a different conversation. Whether you're coming into like whether or not it's unethical to be in a business, I think the answer is that that's a disingenuous question because it really depends on what your focus is. If you're a nonprofit person, sure, run along and do that. I think if you're an investor or if you're looking to raise external capital from people who have investment return requirements, then it's a disingenuous question to ask because you came to raise money from people whose goal is to make money. If you want to build a company that is evergreen and you never raise anybody's money, an example of that, Patagonia is a good example, right? He built this brand of thing, and now he's like, hey, this company
Yeah,
is an
he
evergreen
sold it.
fund. He sold it to himself, essentially. He sold it to like his foundation to make it like an evergreen thing so he never actually make money. But before he did that last year, for the last 20 odd years, they've been a profitable capitalistic market whose customers are mostly bankers. So who are
True.
the apex of finance? Like Patagonia is like finance bro, like apex material, right? So
Standard.
I find that question disingenuous. I think a lot of people ask that question, and I wouldn't spend time arguing, but I think anybody asks that question, either one doesn't know what VC is, two doesn't understand how businesses are funded and run, or three has already decided that African businesses are not business grade. And all three of those things are not things that I personally like to spend my time talking about because it's not part of what I'm not looking at companies that are non-VC. I'm not looking at companies that are not business grade, and I'm trying to make money. So because of that, these questions I don't think are the right questions to ask. I think as a business model, sure they are, but it's not a business that I'm investing in because I get a lot of those companies that are like, hey, I want to do this really good. I'm like, that's great. You should raise more profit money. As a VC, I've raised money from other people who expect to get money back.
For
And my whole
sure.
business model, I don't get paid till they get paid. So as much as it might make you feel warm and tingly inside, the truth of the matter is that the model is capitalism. And unless we want to argue capitalism, in which case, like you should probably go to somebody else. I don't want to argue about capitalism. The argument around whether or not it's unethical is the wrong argument. There's an ethical conversation we have for sure around like
For sure.
how investors treat founders' IP. I think there are critical ethical questions you talk about, but whether or not like investing in a company is an ethical decision, I think it's a conversation that like you have to have individually and then decide where you stand and then pursue that view of the world. Personally, my view is that we should make money for investing in companies.
Definitely, I do agree with you. And at the end of the day, when we think of the role that business has in transforming society, it's undeniable, right? When you sit down and actually ask yourself, what has capitalism done for the world? It's gotten us on this Zoom call, I've got a job, I'm able to pay my bills, I'm able to, do what I gotta do. People are employed, people get educated, etc. So, fundamentally, I find that those are very academic and like, what are
It
they
is.
called? Like barstool conversations of like,
It's good. It's a good
virtue
conversation.
signaling a bit sometimes. But yeah, I mean,
Of course. I mean,
it's
that's what
great
it
to
is.
have.
I mean, yeah, it
Great
should
chat,
be.
but
And I think
yeah, in the room with the VCs, like, that's not the chat to be having.
Right. And the chat, that chat can be had in other spaces, right? There's like a growing number of evergreen funds whose goal isn't to make any money, right? There's people who are also building, there's NGOs that are looking to be made unneeded, right? I think that's because, again, and this is probably a lot of people like me, our fault, right? Like, because VC has like the loudest megaphone, and we sit on Twitter and I write my threads and I do my newsletter. So everybody's like, oh, well, this is how I build a business. And it's like, well, no, I'm writing for a very specific set of people that are building very specific set of businesses. And
People don't
90%
get
of business
that.
in Africa today don't have that, right? People don't get that. I think that, and that's, again, it's probably, again, on people like me, who writes tomes and theses on VC that make it attractive. But realistically speaking, that company is a non-starter because it doesn't speak to what VC is. And you could have that conversation with an impact like DFI or an impact like a venture philanthropy person. They might have some thesis around it. But as a venture capital investor, I'm very focused on impact, but I don't think that we should step into the impact and let it go. Because I mean, if you look at any of the metrics, man, poverty in Africa has been going down every year on year up until 2020, and now it's been going up, and it's higher than we've ever seen it before.
Yo.
Which means more people in poverty, more people make less money, more people are having access to health insurance, more people have access to health care, to food. There's problems that like we can fix with different financing tools. And as a continent, and we always say the word ecosystem, and my friend Amanda hates the word ecosystem, as the word ecosystem, it means multiple different parts. So it's not just VC, it's the revenue-based guys, it's the grants guys, it's the debt guys. Like, we all have different roles to play if we're gonna see this future of what Africa can look like if we find and back the right businesses or build the right infrastructure around it, right? So I think there's multiple places to play, and this is the area that I've chosen to play in, and I'm hoping to play well.
Let me pick on that a bit. You briefly mentioned that, like, the future that we are creating, the future that you'd like to see for Africa, when we position ourselves, just like, let's take a step back, put on our anthropological hats right now for a bit. Looking at certain tech trends, right? We saw mobile money basically leapfrog a lot of, like, legacy infrastructure that would have had to be put in place. If you think of credit, debit cards, etc. I mean, you've been staying in Kenya for, a while now, and you can see there how, easily more people have a lot more access to, mobile money transactions that way than would ever have, like, a bank account, for example. So that's, like, an example of, like, a leapfrog situation where, we didn't have to go through the traditional route that the US or whatever had to go through. If anything, now we're ahead in terms of mobile money adoption. So thinking along the same thread of leapfrogging and the power of technology to advance certain elements of our work, our life. What do you think is in the mix next, right? Like, what technologies or innovations do you see could help us, like, make another similar type of leap, maybe in a different industry or different space?
You're trying to get me in trouble with your asking me to predict the future. Um,
I mean, you try and predict the future, but through your investments. So,
yeah, yeah, I
in a
do.
way.
I do. Okay, so I will say something, and the reason I hate saying, I'm going to caveat by saying that this is the worst time to say this. So, but I'm going to say it anyway. And what's a second caveat? I'm not saying this is today. I am What I'm telling you about is 10 years down the line. I'm not talking about today.
Gotcha.
I do think that there's going to be, I think that for Africa specifically, let's talk about this leapfrogging thing. I've been in the US for 5 weeks now, and I've talked to all my friends. I've been really intrigued by a couple of things. Like, when I'm in Nairobi or in Ghana, where I live in both places, I almost never carry cash between MTN's Mobile Money and M-Pesa from Safaricom. I haven't had to carry cash in forever. I've been in America 5 weeks now. I've gone to ATM multiple times because some places don't take card. A lot of places, they don't have any like mobile money type approach. It's either card or cash. They're the two options you have, right? And A lot of people try to do card in Africa, and we went from cash, skip card, and went to like sending money through your phone, right? And not having to do a download app. But you can do that in America with like Zelle and with
PayPal
Venmo.
and
But
stuff.
all those guys, you have to have a bank account to do it. Whereas like MTN and M-Pesa, you don't have a bank account to do it. So I think like we've definitely leapfrogged in some technologies. So and I wanted to lay that down as a caveat, because let's remember that the only reason we're able to do this more money technology and leapfrog so much is because of USSD innovation, right? And the focus there, and how it went from helping us pay airtime to voting on the radio for like competitions. So now we pay money through USSD as a technology is a real reason why we have all of these things today. So I do think that like what's the next technology that could be interesting for Africa? I think artificial intelligence. And I don't mean it in
Nice.
the way of I don't mean the way of everybody put an AI company. I actually think most people don't have the capacity to build AI companies today. I invested in an AI company 3 years ago before anybody was talking about AI. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about this stuff. But I don't think everybody should build an AI company today. I think a lot of people don't have the capacity, a lot of people have the knowledge base. It's a lot more complex than crypto. And so the entry point is a lot harder. But I do think though that, and there's a really interesting article that Ngozi from Carbon put together. I do think that there's some step changes and it's on artificial intelligence. And he did a very good article around how he has used AI to like scale up a few things within Carbon, the startup. And that's where I think the real value lies. I mean, like right now, listen, if you want to build a tech company, your very first thought is, I'm not, if I if you cannot code, you have to find a developer, right? You have to find a CTO, right? You can do all the things you want, but you need a CTO, right? Or maybe you get when you go talk to your customers, you take all these notes. What you do is you and your customer marketing salesperson sit down and you decipher, figure out, okay, well, we know this from our learnings. We've learned this. How do we figure out? I think so many of those pieces, so many of those step changes are the first, call it 5 years, 6 years of adoption that we need to do. We see more and more people thinking through, nothing about my business has changed. I am still a payments company, or I'm still a lending company, or I'm still an insurance company, but there are pockets of my flows that I'm leveraging in artificial intelligence or machine learning to expand or make me more efficient. I think that's where, so that's what I'm excited about. It's like, how do startups get better at like targeting customers? How do they get better around designing material that like resonate with customers? How does your sales
Handling
and marketing
data.
team and that, but and so that's exciting. That for me is super exciting. But I will say though that the number of people that can take data and do something insane with it are very, very few. But in Africa today, I think that like a lot of, that's why I personally I'm not backing any AI companies in Africa yet. I think that there's a learning gap, and we find people who have the expertise and knowledge and have been working on this, right? Because like every morning we wake up, this AI thing changes a bit more. And as someone, and
True.
I'll caveat by saying, and my colleagues at work know this, I'm a bit of a maximalist. I use AI. I've used AI 4 times already today to give you context, and it's only like 2 p.m. I use AI for everything. And so for me, I've seen how it's changed my own efficiencies. And I think that the ability to imagine, and even this, and when we think about this idea of like diverse founders, so many times to build a company, right, you're limited by a few things. Either you can code or you have a friend who can code. If you don't have those two things, you can't build a company 5, 10, 15 years ago. And you need like 10K, 50K to pay your CTO properly to build all these things. With AI, with no code tools, all of a sudden you don't need to be a technical founder to spin up a startup. You don't need to be a technical founder to think through how to launch your first MVP. I think that is where I'm even more intrigued, is like, can we open the aperture of potential founders? If we can, then we have more of a chance to find those 100x, 200x companies, because VC is an outlier game. And the wider we make the aperture, the more opportunities we get to back people that maybe 5 years ago couldn't. Because like, think about it. Flutterwave, there's very few people who have built Flutterwave 10 years ago. Very few people who have built Paystack 10 years ago. But today, you can build a company with AI as your technical founder. And it's a lot more complicated than I'm saying, which is why, again, back to my point, I don't think a lot of people have the experience enough yet. But I think the smart founders are already testing it out. They're already thinking through what portion of my business can I leverage AI on. And if people, of course, raising money off on the back of the hype, and you expect that to happen, like people need to eat. Like you can knock their hustle. But eventually, I do think this AI thing could be interesting in how we think through leapfrogging technologies in Africa. Oh my God,
I
my AI
definitely am.
soapbox now.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you on that. When we think of just also how fast AI is evolving, it has all the hallmarks of, a disruptive technology. Question often is, how do we use it? So context is really key in that, when you look at the case of, for example, BlackBerry versus Apple, or like the Nokias. It's like, okay, yeah, this mobile thing was taking off. Certain players got in early and, gained some headway. They were getting somewhere, even became, giants at some point. But they didn't really see the end picture really well. Call it hubris, call it complacency, call it what you want. But what always fascinates me is that today, ChatGPT and company are probably the pioneers today. But we'd be very shocked what this thing would look like in like 5, 10 years. We might think that Google is the one that's running this thing in 10 years, but like, maybe it's Jaziel and Co. It's some guy out of his garage who just figured out a different context to operate this thing in. So that's really fascinating. For me personally, one of the things I'm betting on is, yes, AI, but also decentralized tech. So, blockchain technology. I think that it has lots of upside. Number one, because if we think of a lot of our systems or lack thereof, a lot of African corporations, organizations, governments are struggling with this thing of like transparency, struggling with this thing of settling things in a fair way. How do you, issue resources and set in protocols that govern the systems or govern how we deal with our money or how we value stuff? I think blockchain technology and, I wouldn't call it crypto. I think crypto has a bad name right now. Crypto is like
Yeah, but no, you're right.
dirty.
Blockchain is a game changer.
Yeah.
I think the problem blockchain was that because there was a monetary angle to it, it very easily
Yeah.
became a speculative conversation, right? I think the technology
Exactly.
itself is interesting. Like, it
Yeah.
makes, and I've seen some really interesting use cases of blockchain technology, the transparency, the decentralization. Like, and
Exactly.
I think that's why I'm excited about AI, because of course AI doesn't have a clear financial benefit to it. I think there might be a bit more breathing space for people to try new things, but I do think
Right.
that, yeah, crypto is crazy, but blockchain as a technology is definitely one of those like step changes. But I think a lot of people forget though that when the internet happened in 1999, Netflix wasn't around for like 10 more years after that. Like, before we went from internet to
Right.
decentralized server providers that make Spotify work, or the design provider that makes streaming work, and now we all stream. It took like 15 years. Like, it's been in 2023. We probably got into the streaming wars like 2012, 2012 in
Yeah,
America,
two
before we
thousand
the rest of the
twelve.
world like 4 years ago. That's like a 10-year cliff, right? And I think so many people forget that,
Yeah.
like, 5 years ago, crypto was a big deal, like in 2016, and then it really ran and it ran up, and now it's crashed, but you're still within that 7 year, 10 year like
Yeah.
horizon. So there's something interesting there for
Young.
sure. I think I think there's a problem. I think the real problem today is that because we've grown in a world that seems to remind us of instant like results, we oftentimes have a biased view to how the internet has evolved. Because internet as it exists today, when it came out in 2000 in 1999, let's not forget Y2K happened. Everybody thought the world was going to end
True.
when to the 2000 start end, because like, people were like, this internet thing is
Yeah.
crazy, it's going to shut
The
us all
bubble
down.
popped.
Then the bubble popped, and then it went crazy. Everybody gave all the dot-com companies money, and then they failed. And then we went into like 2008. Like, I think unfortunately people don't read history enough, so people
They
forget the
don't.
fact that like when the internet came out, it's been 25 years since then. Like,
Yeah.
it takes a while to get to a world where now the internet is ubiquitous, and even that, it's not ubiquitous everywhere else in the world, right? Like,
It's
how much
not.
data across Africa versus like, so yeah, I think that, unfortunately for crypto, a lot of people were selling this short-term hype of like, oh, it's going to change the world in 5 years. But The days are the years may be short, but the days are very, very long. And so it will take us a while to get there, but I think we will. And we'll see how it goes. We'll see how it goes.
So let's switch back to you, Jaziel. Where do you see yourself next 5 to 10 years? And what are you looking forward to as a human, as an investor? We can touch on all of those different angles. Like what's
Okay,
up for
good.
Jaziel?
What is up for me? I'll be honest, I'm not a big fan of 5, 10 year plans. I get people who do it. I think it makes sense for them. It doesn't make sense for me because my life a year ago, I didn't have a Twitter account. Now, like 9,000, almost 9,000 people follow me on Twitter. It wasn't in my 5 year plan, right? My 5 year
Crazy.
plan would not even think about Twitter. So I don't know what that 5 years look like. So I can't answer that question. I will say though that what I am looking forward to doing is a few things. One, I love to continue to be present in my daily life, just with my friends and my partner, with my family. I think the second thing I'm really focused on is, I think the next 5, 10 years is this. I don't know if this is the audience for this, but I also am Christian. And so, really, like in the next 5, 10 years, continuing to deepen and expand my own Christian relationship and how that works out for me personally, and like, of course, in my life and moving
Word.
forward. And then finally, I just want to keep backing innovation in Africa. Ideally, I want to be backing only women, but I can't do that in my day job, so I'll keep doing that in my angel investing. But yeah, backing the future of innovation, man, is that, I think for me, that's the holy grail. I think that, and the impact is amazing. I think like the potential impact is definitely there. But I'll also be honest, like if you look at the numbers, like you build wealth in very few ways. You don't build wealth by being an employee, right? You build wealth either owning a business or investing in a business, you own a piece of the business. And this job, unlike any other, is uniquely designed to help you find business to own a piece of. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. And I think the final thing I'm really looking forward to, I think a lot of people know me for investing in innovation, but I'm really one of the things I'm really excited about is investing in the arts. So I own a few different
Nice.
painting pieces, mostly from, as you know, all from Black or brown artists. I'm in the process of co-sponsoring this photographer who I quite like. I own a few of his pieces. He's having his first solo show in Accra in December, and I'm co-sponsoring that. So I think
Nice.
in the next 5 years, I want to be doing more non-tech investments as well, whether it's film, whether it's music, whether it's art, because I do think that this idea of giving money to people to build the future doesn't have to be limited to technology alone.
True.
And I personally, I mean, if you look at Netflix Black Book, right? A lot of VCs invested in that, I think, and that's Netflix's first global number one like film from Africa. I think there's a lot that we can do. It doesn't have to be on Netflix, but I think there's a lot we can do to back the creatives in emerging markets. And too often than not, we don't do that job. So I'm actually quite excited to do a few more of that. That's more like a 10-year plan, I'd say, is to get really into investing art and music.
It's interesting. I came across, it was actually on TikTok, and they were profiling some guy. I think he's, man, easily a billionaire right now. And he basically came up with this like VC model. I guess as someone who understands VC, I'd now attach a label to that and call it like a VC model. But basically what he was doing was investing in guys like what is it like movie directors, like really, really talented movie directors way back. Like the Michael Bays, the what's this other guy called?
Like Quentin Tarantino, yeah, like Jeffrey,
Like
like those
those
good.
guys. And he really put a lot of money into films, and I mean the turnover was crazy. So that one really blew my mind, because I was like, wow, investing as an art, it can go many ways, and there's lots of ways that humans create value. And as someone who has resources in one way or another, you can get a piece of that value in one way or another. So I think that's definitely a perk of being a VC, is that you start to understand that innately. And yeah, I definitely need to hit you up. Some of these syndicates, they're sounding interesting. I don't want to be that guy who was like, man, I had this guy on my podcast and he did tell me about this thing and I did absolutely nothing about it. But definitely, Jaziel, this has been a fantastic conversation. And just to wrap us up, we do what's called the elevator segment right at the end of our podcasts where we picture this scenario, right? We've had this great conversation in our, quote unquote, boardroom. And so you're walking out, getting into the elevator, and one of our eager interns kind of like stops you in there. And, on the way down, they have a couple of quick fire questions to ask you. So are you ready to get into some quick fire questions?
I will do as much as I can.
Right. First one is if you were to recommend one book that and maybe I think you mentioned it earlier, but who knows? But if you were to recommend one book, everyone should just pick up right now and read. And you think that whatever they'd learn or discover from that thing would be life-changing, what book would that be?
You're asking the wrong person. I like read mostly
Yeah.
fiction. I mostly read
Yeah.
fiction.
Fiction changes lives.
Okay, in which case, there's actually a book that I read, and I don't
Yeah.
know if most people, I'm sure most people, I feel like I should have like a deeper answer, like a book that would like,
No, no,
but
no, no, no.
I'm sorry to your audience. I'm sorry I don't have a good self-help. I don't read self-help. But if you're into fiction, I actually read this book by this Nigerian, I think she's British Nigerian, or she's Nigerian living in Britain. This book called The List. It's a really interesting
The
book, and I think the
list.
reason I've told multiple people about this book, and the reason I told about this book is it's a very interesting look into the potential impact of social media on our lives and our relationships, and just how, as someone who spent a lot of time on Twitter and tweeting on Twitter, like it's very interesting to see how people treat you when they think that you're not a real human being and because you like tweet online. And this book does a very interesting job of showing how like social media can, for right and wrong reasons, like really destroy lives. And but in a
Wow.
very beautiful story that is wrapped around this Ghanaian and Nigerian couple. It's a beautiful piece.
Interesting. The
An amazing
list.
book. An amazing book. The List for sure. Yeah, she's great.
I'm
Yomi, I think it was
gonna
by Yomi Adegoke, I think. Yeah, she was amazing. It's an amazing book.
I love that. I love that. No need to apologize to our audience. They are, of diverse backgrounds and would definitely appreciate
Amazing.
the change in tempo. Second question would be, what's your favorite childhood memory?
Whew. I've always been like a reader at heart. So I think probably my favorite childhood memory is like, I don't know if, I'm sure it was the same thing in Kenya, but there was like this boat that used to come along to Ghana called like the MV Logos Hope. It was like this like ship that went around the world and like had these books, and they would dock in Ghana. Any year they dock, my parents would like, my father especially and my mom would make sure we go so we can buy a couple of books. And I always grew up
Nice.
reading, so that's probably my favorite memories. It's going to get books from there, but anyway, I think I saw that they were relaunching it recently, but I don't know if it's back up. But MV Logos Hope, going to that to read books was definitely, also buy books that I can read later, it was a good time.
Lovely, lovely. Last question. If you had to have a billboard in the middle of the busiest street of your choosing, could be in Accra, Nairobi, whichever city of your choice, but it's on a really busy street. Empty billboard, you could write whatever message it is, but you are sure that a large number of people would walk by, drive by, and read it. What did you have written on that billboard?
Probably like a short link to like my pipeline forum. For those who don't
No
know, I
way.
deal. Yeah, what? I'm trying to find deals. Like because I think that so many VCs like get their deals from warm introductions, and that like limits you. Like I'm trying. If I could find the biggest, if I had money for a billboard in like Nairobi, Lagos,
Yeah, put up
where
like a
else? Where else?
QR
Like
code.
Kigali. Like QR code is too far, so people like will not get time to scan it. But if it's like a really
Yeah.
short like bit, like let's say bit.ly slash like Jazeel or something, and it's
Yeah.
like, are you building something interesting? Click it. Like
Click here. Yeah.
honestly, I would do that, and I will put that in because I built this. For those who don't know, I used again AI to help me build. I don't code. I've never coded a day in my life.
Yeah.
unless you count making ringtones on a Nokia 3310 when I was like 15 years,
Oh man, no, that does
12
not
years
count.
old. If it doesn't count, then yeah, I don't code. But using ChatGPT and AI, I built this inbound pipeline form that founders can share with me. Like their companies are building, answer a couple of questions, and it'll automatically either send them to me or let them know why it's not a fit for me. And it has been very helpful for me. I think now, last I checked, about 100 and almost 20 people, almost 20 founders have shared their decks with me over the last, since May 29th. So over the last
Nice.
6 months or so. And so
Nice.
if I had a billboard, yeah, I'd definitely put that link up because I think there's so many people who are building really interesting, especially really early ideas that may not know that there's a whole way to build the right business, number one. But there's a world where you can find funding, and I'd like to get the most deals without having to deal with like who knows who, you know? Like, yeah. So that's what I probably do.
Yeah, that's an efficient man talking right there.
Yeah, man. Listen, I'm
Definitely
trying to do
AI, AI
deals.
is for
Actually,
you.
I might steal this idea, you know. I might go check into how much it costs to put a
You might
billboard
have to
in
do that.
Nairobi
Yeah.
because it will probably work. All people building stuff. You know what? You give me an
Yeah.
idea. I'm gonna look into this. I'm
Yeah.
gonna look
Definitely,
into this.
definitely.
Billboard, that's wild.
That's really awesome. And do you have any parting shots just for, anyone who is thinking of building, interested in building, vaguely curious, and maybe they found this conversation really insightful. I know that you do have office hours on your Twitter that you run, etc. Yeah, where can people find you, and what can they expect when they do find you?
For sure. Well, first, to people who are thinking about building stuff, I think if you're thinking about it, if you're already building stuff, first of all, shout out to you. I think you're in or deciding to go into a very difficult journey, but it's one that can be very exciting, very insightful. If you're going to build, I love the maxim that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. If you're going to take this step into entrepreneurship, regardless of like what the newsletters and what the Twitters say, it is not a fun walk in the park. It's going to be easily the hardest thing you're going to do. And you're going to do just one thing for at least 5 to 10 years if you're successful. So if you're going to take the entrepreneurship route, it's a difficult route, but it's a worthy route to take. Find the right partners around you to help you get far. And always, always, I'd say, do not stop learning. I think as if more founders just like continue to read and learn, you see what has worked, what has failed, and you can build something really, really interesting there. And if all the things I've said today sounds interesting to you, you can find me a couple of different places. So as Sean mentioned, I am on Twitter. I write quite a bit. My handle is Jaziel Invests. That is JASIEL Invests with an S at the end. I share daily insights on African startups. African tech startups and gender lens investing. I also publish a bi-weekly newsletter called the Startup Definition Sunday. It's a bi-weekly newsletter for founders or emerging founders that are looking to get actionable insights that they can implement today. Every issue comes out every other Sunday. The next issue is coming up this Sunday. And every issue, I try to do four things: share one actionable tip with the founder, share one gift to the founder, share one article that they can read. Sorry, three things that. One article on Africa Tech that they should read. And about almost 1,000 people now, really close to 1,000 actually, people read these newsletter on a bi-weekly basis. And so if you're a founder or you're an aspiring founder or you're an investor who's looking to continue to expand, learn more about tips for founders, feel free to check out my newsletter. All these things are linked in my Twitter. And finally, like Sean alluded to, I host together with my colleague Marge, who is Marge and Tambi, on Twitter. We co-host a bi-weekly office hours. That is an hour, a dedicated hour for founders who are looking to either perfect their pitch or brainstorm specific challenges with investors or other founders. We run this on a bi-weekly basis. The next session, I believe, is on November 16th. And this session is going to be the last session, our last session for Q4. We run four sessions per quarter. and then take a two week break before coming back up in the new year. So we'll be back up in the new year. But yeah, if you're a founder, come join us next Thursday, November 16th. I believe the time is 5 p.m. West Africa time or 7 p.m. East Africa time. Join us. It's an hour, and a lot of founders have found a lot of value from the office hours that we share. But overall, man, thanks for having me here today. It's been a great time chatting with you.
Yeah, Jaziel, this has been fantastic. Listeners, I hope that you have learned as much as you can. Jaziel is a pretty cool guy, and just from the amount of time that he takes in curating his community, making sure that entrepreneurs are well-versed, well-educated in what they need to know, but also well-supported from an investments and financing standpoint. Jaziel does stand out in the industry as someone who's super approachable in that sense. So yeah, reach out. He's very, very, I mean, I've attended a couple of the Twitter office hours in particular, and just listening to you giving very tangible advice to, let's say, founders who join and like pitch their idea, etc. There's so much to be learned by everyone. So yeah, guys, go check him out. Jaziel Martin Odum, Africa Investment Officer at Axion Venture Lab. Incredible guy, as you've heard, a bookworm, and he's really given us a gem here, The List. I've even noted it down, man. I have to read that book. And definitely will be in touch, get to pick your brain a bit more. And listeners, if you want a part two, let us know. But thank you so much. If you reached this far in the episode, we appreciate you. We release these every Tuesday. We have our guest episodes going out. So if you haven't already, go and check out our previous episodes that we've released this week. We've been speaking to really incredible people just like Jaziel here. And yeah, we learn every day. I keep saying that this podcast is like, it's like an MBA. Like the 2 years we've been doing this, I feel like I've gone to business school for real. So thank you, Jazzy, for your contribution, your time here. And listeners, we shall see you on the flip side. Have a fantastic week ahead.
Thanks for having me here, Sean.